I was just saying to them, just as it started, for some reason I decided that reading here called for posh shoes, and they're killing my feet. But this story is actually serious, but you'll notice that having painful feet is probably going to help me, because that's what my protagonist has a problem, is not well. So anyway, so if I wince, I might be acting, but I'm probably just actually feeling my feet are sore. But the wanderer. They should give me something and be done with it. Someone is fiddling with the angle of the bed, but nothing they do stops the pain in my legs. I am dying from the toes up. There's a hand on my elbow. Wake up, Gladys. I have a cup of tea for you. It's the Polak nurse, Halina. The way she speaks takes me back to the old house. Lillian and me giggling behind the curtains as Yannick and Pop argue over the precise way to prune the rhododendron. We're in the parlour with the tulip-tiled fireplace. Above it is Pop's favourite print, returned to pride of place the moment the war was over. Pop thinks that he is the wanderer above a sea of fog. I caught him once posing in front of it, standing in the window frame, his hand resting lightly on his own walking stick as he surveyed imaginary mountain peaks poking above the green fog of our lawn. But in this memory, the sun is shining and he's barking orders at Yannick as though they are still in the guard room. But when Pop bends down to lift the shears, Yannick turns suddenly and blows a kiss to me, and I am in midair turned from a dull drop of water into a snowflake. My memory slides round 180 degrees to look at Lillian again, to see if she noticed. But she's busy laughing, a strand of her hair caught on her eyelash, a golden curl bobbing up and down as she giggles. In every way, she's better than me. I turn back to Yannick. In every way but one. My memory shifts unbidden, and I'm alone by the same window. I welcome the evening chill in the air, still in the thrill of the blown kiss. The light has been out in Yannick's room above the garage all evening, but soon he will come home and I'll call good night as though it's just coincidence that I should see him. As I wait, I see Lillian is saying good night herself to a young man at the gate. He's awkwardly dressed in a suit that doesn't quite fit. As he leans in, she ducks away and he calls out in exasperation, and I jolt forward so that my head bangs against the open window, for it's Yannick. And I knew then, oh foolish girl that I was, that the afternoon's kiss was meant for her. I was soon to learn that the kisses would always be for someone else. Until George, that is. Until George. George will come one day, maybe today. Halina breaks through my thoughts as she lifts me forward in the crook of her arm. I must have said George out loud. I try not to let her see how it hurts. My eyelids won't stay open as my mind takes me to the Saturday afternoon in the Legion when I saw George for the first time. Was it 3 years ago or four? What does it matter now? Mabel and Alice and I were playing cribbage. Mabel hates playing three-handed. Neither one thing nor the other, she says, with her mouth pulled in like a cat's behind. She was the first to spot George standing by the door, and I swear her bosom grew even larger when she beckoned him over. He had a good head of hair on him, and a smart tweed suit that was only slightly frayed at the collar, but it was the perfectly polished burgundy shoes that caught my eye, and the way he rested his hand lightly on his walking stick. "You look like a man who knows cards," Mabel said, catching his free hand with one of hers, while the other rested on her chest. "Would you join us in a game of cribbage? We so need to be a four." My stomach clenches as I remember how his eyes hooked mine as he said, "If one of you lovely ladies will teach me." That look made me brave, and I moved my chair to make room. I offered to buy him a drink after the game to celebrate our win, marvelling at my own bravado. He savoured every drop, and then he kissed my cheek with whiskey lips and was gone. But next Saturday, we played again, and again we won. I can taste now the gingerbread and port we had for tea in my little flat. I would never have thought of taking those two together, but George had me doing a lot of things that afternoon that I had never thought to do before. If I concentrate just when I'm at the crossing point between wakefulness and sleep, I can conjure up the feeling of his body next to mine, the curve of his back barely touching my side, the sound of his breathing. Sometimes I open my eyes very slightly in the night and see the hump of his shoulders outlined against the wall, his silvery head denting the pillow. Halina wants me to eat some cereal mashed in milk. But how can I, when I know how it will end up, squeezed out of me like filthy toothpaste into the plastic pouch that lies in bed with me, that someone will have to empty? Why eat anyway? so I can feel this pain for longer? I don't even have the concentration to read. George used to read to me. Shakespeare, Jane Austen, The Telegraph. I didn't care what he read. I just liked the sound of his West Country voice rolling over the words. On my first days here, the staff would dress me and sit me in the chair by the window. I thought myself so superior to the others, lying in bed in their 90s, staring at the ceiling. But gradually it became too much for me too, my sluggish blood struggling against gravity, my ears buzzing when they sat me up. And so now, I too stay in bed. We're all shrinking, losing track of the days, slipping out of conversation. I'm withdrawing from my own body. George could be such good company. From time to time, he would come home with money in his pocket, and there would be treats, champagne, venison, strawberry tarts, for a short time at least. Lying here is making me feel guilty about Lillian. I forgave her for Yannick, but I never forgave her for the things she said about George. I should have visited her when she was in hospital, but she didn't tell me how ill she was. I suppose she didn't want to worry me. After all, who have I told? Not Mabel or Alice, or the Franklins next door. Why would I want them to come? I'd have to crawl out of myself to talk to them. But a sister is different. I would have wanted Lillian. The hospital only phoned me after she died because they had me down as next of kin. George was wonderful that day. He never took her dislike personally. I lay across his lap and wept while he read from a hymn book he'd found in a charity shop and stroked my hair. He took me to the bus station and made sure I was on the right bus for Margate. Take as long as you need, he'd said. I'll take care of things here. Each night when I was away, I'd ring him on our home phone and he'd tell me how he missed me. Was it the second Wednesday or the Friday that the phone was answered by someone else? A young man. He laughed when I asked who he was. I thought he had the wrong number, so I rang again, and he answered again. What are you doing there? I said. That's my home. His answer was succinct. Not anymore, missus. It was 5 months before I got them out. I remember the court case, with the councilwoman sitting next to me, disbelieving everything I said, and the magistrates looking at me with more pity than I ever want to see in anyone's eyes again. I used all my savings to pay for the repairs. I thought they'd reconnect the gas and electricity once I got the flat back, but they wanted more money for the unpaid bills, and I had none left. I tried, the councilwoman said, but the policy is very clear. You gave away your keys, so it's your responsibility. But it wasn't me. It was George. He turned up at the door 3 weeks after I got back in the flat. I hadn't seen him in all that time, but I knew it would only have been that he didn't know where to find me. Not that he would have told me that himself. He was too proud. He noticed the print right away. I'd brought it back from Lillian's. Wanderer above a sea of fog, he read. What does that mean then? I thought of telling him how important it had been to Pop, but I was worried he might try to get some money for it. He reminds me of you, I said, and he smiled, and I knew then that everything would be all right again. I knew he wanted to apologise, but it was just too hard for him. Eventually I asked him gently what had happened to the keys that I'd left with him, and he admitted that he'd got talking to someone in the pub who'd been very persuasive. He had seemed such a nice young man who only wanted somewhere to stay for a few weeks. The councilwoman said that the going rate for a set of keys was £200, and George had parted with them for a few whiskies, if he's to be believed. But if he had taken money, there was none left by the time he came home, and I owed over £600 on the gas and electricity they'd used, that and the phone bill. I didn't tell George it was that much, of course. He felt badly enough. The councilwoman, Marissa, said she could get me a crisis loan to get reconnected, but I had to promise not to see George again, and I couldn't do that. And he was so very, very sorry. Candles are romantic, my lovely, he would say, pouring himself another glass of port as we huddled under the covers. And you have my love to keep you warm. But I was cold when he wasn't there. I remember the policewoman's face when I let her in, like she was counting the candle stubs, her eyes running over the coffee table, the floor, and the windowsills. It's the only way to keep warm, I'd said, trying to smile. I don't really notice it anymore. But I noticed she sat on the edge of the sofa, with her eye on the door. I've had a report from the council, she'd said, pressing her knees tightly together and folding her arms against her body. I'm told George Thompson stays here from time to time. I'm looking to arrest him for fraud. But I don't want to make a complaint, I said, thinking that would be the end of it. I'm not here about you, she said. I tried to concentrate while she explained. It seems there were two of us. As I listened, I found I could cope with him being unfaithful in bed, but the thought that he had taken another woman's money, that he was giving her the same excuses, that that woman was forgiving him, was unbearable. It didn't help that the policewoman kept repeating herself and asking if I understood, when I just wanted her to shut up and go away. Never mind the candles, she said. It's really bloody cold in here, taking hold of my hand, and I don't like the look of you. She called up on the radio and waited until the doctor came. Sitting around in freezing cold rooms is no good for anyone, he said. Did you not think to bring these feet to me sooner, Gladys? I'm not going to live in a home, I said. George wouldn't be able to stay with me in one of those places. You won't be living anywhere if I don't get you to hospital, the doctor said. The policewoman picked up my handbag as the ambulance arrived. I'll look after your keys this time, she said. But when I started writing a note for George, she closed her hand around mine. Can you not see what that bastard's done to you? She said. He's all I've got. I shook her fingers off. Do you think I want to be on my own? What good is heat and light when you've no one who cares whether you live or die? He's the only one who's ever loved me. I don't care if he's a bastard. Pardon? Helena is by my bed again. I must have spoken aloud. I try to see her expression, but focusing is too much effort. I feel her fiddling under the bedclothes. It's time to change the pouch again. I imagine I am that man on the mountain crag, but I can't stay above the fog. I let it seep upwards, overtaking Helena's busy hands. I sense George lying behind me. If I lean back, perhaps he'll stroke my hair.